I pushed once and the nurse was like, stop pushing, because she was like about to come out.
Welcome to the Milestone Mama Podcast. I'm your host, Chelsea Hollis, wife, boy mom, and former fitness instructor turned photographer, educator, and birth doula. Becoming a mom in 2020 completely changed my life. And even though it was the greatest joy I've ever felt, it definitely came with some challenges that no one could have ever prepared me for. But I found so much healing and community, and that's why this podcast was born. Tune in each week as we uncover all of the nuances of being a mom, from pregnancy, birth, postpartum, and everything in between. If you're ready to connect, to grow, to learn, to feel inspired, seen, and heard, then you've come to the right place. And I'm so glad you're here, Mama. Let's go ahead and get this thing started.
Okay, we are back with another birth story episode. We have Megan Tolley here again. This is, I think, her, this will be your third time on the podcast now.
Yeah.
She was on our labor and delivery nurse podcast episode, and then also on our community call on miscarriage. So thank you for coming back to share your birth stories with us.
Thank you for having me again.
Of course, it's a pleasure. So you're going to be sharing the story of both of your children today. So I'm just going to let you take the floor and hop right in. You can start from wherever you feel like is appropriate to tell the beginning of the story.
Okay. So to lead off, today is my oldest child's birthday. He's 2.
Oh, happy birthday, Leo.
So it's like, oh, it's his birth story. Yeah. Sorry, I'm feeding my other baby. So basically with him, I had a pretty chill pregnancy, up until the last like 5 weeks. I was really swollen, but my blood pressure was still fine. And then I went, to the doctor and it was creeping up a little bit, but they were like, oh, we'll just watch it. And then, it was a Sunday. I was at home and, just feeling like crap. And so, and I had a really bad headache. So I took my own blood pressure because I have a manual cuff. And since I'm a nurse, I know how to do that. And it was really high. So I called my doctor and they called me back and told me to come into the emergency room. My husband, Matt, was at work. And so my mom drove me and she was like, well, let's bring your bag. And I was 37 weeks and 5 days. And I was like, well, I don't think I'm going to have to stay. They'll probably just give me medicine and I'll leave. I was very ignorant. I wasn't a labor nurse yet. I had no idea about induction or anything. Yep. I just thought the baby would come on their own. I get there and they take my blood pressure and it's still elevated and they give me some medicine for my headache and it went away. So the doctor was like, well, you're far enough along. We'll just keep you for an induction. And I was started crying and freaking out because I was not prepared at all.
Just due to the blood pressure, or were they diagnosing you with preeclampsia yet? Or what was kind of the...
So they're diagnosing me with gestational hypertension. So it wasn't preeclampsia because my headache went away.
Yeah.
And if it was, they would have put me on magnesium and I would have had to have a Foley catheter and stay in bed and all this stuff. So I was grateful that it didn't advance to that. I think maybe if I would have waited longer, it probably would have.
Yeah.
So, So my husband finally got there. He was at work. So he drove in from Durham. It took him a total of like 15, 20 minutes to get there because he sped very fast. they started my induction that night with a Foley bulb. I was already dilated like a fingertip. So that night I just had the Foley bulb and was supposed to go to sleep. I didn't sleep very much because it's very uncomfortable, the Foley bulb. So the next morning I ate breakfast, and then they were like, we're going to start your Pitocin. So they started that. My Foley bulb came out around, trying to remember what time, maybe like 11 in the morning, and my water had like partially broken. So they broke it the rest of the way.
So that's and interesting. Then so they started you on Pitocin with the catheter still in?
Yes. So that's just what they do at this practice. Because I, working at Duke, we usually start people on that misoprostol or Cytotec.
Right.
And with the Foley bulb, because it more softens your cervix, while the Pitocin just really helps you dilate.
Right, right.
So yeah, so they did that. They broke my wire the rest of the way. And then I was about 4 centimeters. And then contractions really started picking up, and they rechecked me, and I was like 6. So I decided to get, well, I tried some IV pain medicine, and at this hospital, they offer nitrous oxide to kind of help with the pain management, but it didn't do anything, and I didn't like the way the IV pain medicine made me feel. So I decided to go for the epidural, even though I'm terrified of needles being a nurse. So I decided to get it, and then I was able to take like a 2-hour nap, which was great. It worked really well for me. And then that was around, I got the epidural around like 2:30, 3 o'clock. Took a 2-hour nap, and then woke up, was hanging out with my mom. My husband were there, and then other family. This was before COVID, so other family was in the waiting room and like kept coming in and out. And then around 6 something, I started getting very uncomfortable, feeling a lot of pressure. And they checked me, and they said I was like 9. So we just kept flipping me back and forth using different positions and this thing called a peanut ball helps keep your pelvis open so the baby can descend. And then, sorry, she's a very loud eater. and then a little bit later, they checked me again, and the nurse was actually checking me, and she was like, well, you can do some practice pushes. You're like 9.5. And I pushed once, and she was like, oh my God. Okay. So they tried to call the doctor because I was 10 centimeters, but she was delivering a lady down the hall who didn't have an epidural. So it's good that she was with them, but my nurse was amazing. And I pushed like maybe like 4 more times. I pushed for like 10 minutes. It's very unlikely for you to push that long, but I pushed really fast.
Yeah.
And he was here.
That's incredible. I was going to say, like, that sounds like a very, like an anomaly when it comes to how long your induction was and how long you pushed for a first time mom. Like that's quick.
Yeah. It was ridiculous. I was so amazed that I had gone that fast, but I also like didn't know until I was a labor nurse that inductions could take so long. So
yeah,
I was very grateful that it didn't take that long.
Yeah.
But yeah, and then postpartum with him was harder with his eating and stuff. Matt, can you come grab her? Say hi, Maggie.
Hi. Oh my gosh, hello, she's getting so big.
She's huge. But yeah, the birth story, his birth was very uncomplicated compared to how I had to be induced and everything. It was
right.
I'm just amazed that it's been 2 years already.
I know. I can't even imagine. That's crazy. It flew by. I remember doing y'all's like family pictures when he was what, like a few weeks old?
Yeah, he was like
a month maybe.
Yeah, maybe a month. It was, I think it was like the middle or end of October. So yeah.
Yeah.
That's crazy. He was so small too compared to Maggie.
Yeah.
she's big.
Teeny little guy. Yeah. So you mentioned postpartum was a little difficult with him. What were some of those challenges?
So with him, in the hospital, because he was so small, and a little bit earlier, because he was born at 37 and 6, so they wanted to check his blood sugars, and he wasn't the best breastfeeder, so we gave him donor milk when we were in the hospital, because his blood sugar was kept getting low, and we did have a bad experience with the nurse. She basically came in, like busted through the door and was like, you need to feed him or his sugars are going to be low and he's going to the NICU. And I was like crying, all those hormones. And so his sugars ended up being fine, but it was very stressful for a first time mom that had no idea what she was doing. But I was totally fine with giving him donor milk and stuff. And then the lactation consultants were great and helped out a lot with feeding. And they taught Matt how to help me when we went home.
That sucks that you had to deal with a non-empathetic person like that when that's like the first experience you have as a first-time mom. That's not the type of treatment you should be getting. And I'm sure, especially now that you are in that field, you know what the standard of care should be, and that it's very unfortunate.
Yeah, and that's why, like, a lot of the times when I have these first-time moms as patients now, I encourage breastfeeding, but I remind them, like, the first 24 hours the baby's gonna be super sleepy, and it's okay if we have to give them like donor milk or formula, because you have the colostrum, but sometimes the babies need a little bit more because their sugars are low, especially if the mom's like gestational diabetes or the baby's like super, super small. Yeah. They just need a little extra because their sugars are a little lower.
And it's so important to give moms that grace, because especially if they go in like wanting to exclusively breastfeed. I'm someone who felt that way too, where when they suggested formula on night one, I was like, like, I just was so guilt. I felt so much guilt and I was super hesitant, but I just wasn't educated on that. Like, oh, that's normal. And that's okay. And it doesn't mean the rest of your experience is going to be necessarily doomed because you needed to do what was right for your baby in that moment. So.
Yeah. And that's what, I mean, I was the same way. I didn't want to give them formula, so I decided to do the donor milk with the syringe feeding, because I had gone to a breastfeeding class and thought it was, I knew everything about it, and then realized I knew nothing. And no one in my family had breastfed. So I was basically like the only one. And I mean, I was formula fed. There's nothing wrong with. And then we ended up switching to formula a little later on anyway.
Yeah. I was formula fed too. And I feel like I turned out just all right. So
yeah, exactly. I'm smart.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm a nurse.
Exactly. That's something to be proud of. But yeah, that's a whole nother topic in and of itself, but the guilt and the shame and the, like, breastfeeding is incredible. I will always advocate for it. I think if women want to do it, they should have all the support. Yes, it needs to be like more destigmatized, but I see both sides of it. I see people that are weird about it and, like, you know, shaming moms in public for doing it and that side. But then there's also a very dominant side of people shaming moms for not doing it. So we need to find a happy medium that encompasses healthy everybody mentally. Yeah. And
at
physically.
Least you're feeding your baby. You're not letting him or her starve. You're giving them the nutrients they need, no matter how they get it.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. So how did everything go with your pregnancy and birth with Maggie?
So with Maggie, the pregnancy was, it went really well. Also, my pregnancy with Leo, I had kidney stones. So with this one, I didn't, thank God. And then also I didn't have any swelling until like the last 2 weeks, which was great. Cause with Leo, it was like the last 5 weeks.
That's a long time.
Yeah. And then postpartum, you know, the swelling takes forever to go down. So I didn't see my ankles for like 2 months.
Oh my gosh.
With her, the swelling all went down like a month or a week later, which was great. But yeah, with her, the hardest thing, I ended up having polyhydramnios, which is too much amniotic fluid. They tested me for gestational diabetes twice during this pregnancy because I was considered high risk from the gestational hypertension in my previous pregnancy. So they tested me twice for that, and I got an extra ultrasound at 32 weeks. When I was 32 weeks, that's when they saw she was actually transverse. She wasn't head down yet, and that I had too much amniotic fluid. So then all the ultrasound techs kept asking me if I had gestational diabetes, because that's usually polyhydramnios is caused by that, or like something else wrong with the baby, like they're not swallowing the fluid or something. But no, it just sometimes they don't know why. And so my belly was measuring like 36, 37 weeks at 32 weeks.
Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off there.
No, you're fine.
I always am curious when I hear about, like, I've never heard of that condition. I've heard of not enough amniotic fluid, but mm-hmm. I always wonder, like, I mean, throughout my whole pregnancy, all they did was 2 ultrasounds and they measured fundal height. So how are they able to determine if there's too much or not enough fluid without necessarily doing an ultrasound? Like, how would the fundal height show like fluid versus the size of the baby?
So fundal height after a certain amount of weeks is how, like, from the fundal height equals the amount of weeks pregnant you are. So if you're measuring like bigger or smaller, then they would do an ultrasound to see what your fluid is or how big the baby is, like thinking, oh, the baby might be too big or too small.
Okay.
At 32 weeks, she was measuring 7 pounds, 11 ounces on the ultrasound, but the ultrasound can be wrong up to 3 pounds each way, I think.
That's
so 3 pounds less or 3 pounds more. Yeah. So
the big margin of error.
Yeah. Not very accurate for the weight of the baby, but the fluid, that's how they measure the fluid. They measure the amount of space around the baby to get a amniotic fluid index or an AFI, and mine was elevated. So they did another ultrasound at 36 weeks. And by then she was head down, thank God. And the fluid, the AFI had gone up. So I was still having more fluid at 36 weeks. I was measuring 40 weeks. So then after that appointment, they were like, well, we're going to do a 39 week induction unless you go into labor beforehand, which I was hoping, but it didn't happen. And they said every week we're going to do a biophysical profile, which is basically just another ultrasound to look at baby and measure like if she's moving everything, if she's breathing, because they do practice breathing, and their heart rate and stuff, and then measure the AFI. So I did that 37 and 38 weeks. And then it was at 38 weeks is actually lower, which I was like, does that mean that I don't have it anymore? And they're like, no, you're still in the range that you have polyhydramnios. So we'll still do the induction.
I always wonder, like, when the amniotic fluid goes down, like, where does it go?
I think it gets like reabsorbed. Or the baby swallows it. And then I'm like, well, maybe she just didn't pee. Because yeah. Amniotic fluid is baby pee. So I'm like,
yeah,
maybe she just hasn't peed it out. And they can so look crazy. At like her bladder in there and be like, oh, her bladder's full. She needs to pee.
So crazy. It's so nuts mm-hmm. how that all works.
But they also, at each biophysical profile appointment, they wouldn't tell me like how much bigger she's getting. So I was like terrified she's going to be like 9-10 pounds, because they say, oh, the baby gains 1/2 pound a week after 32 weeks or something. So I was like, great. It's
probably better that they didn't tell you if they thought she was big.
Yeah.
Like it can be such a mind block thing.
Yeah. Oh, actually, she was 7 pounds, 11 ounces, they said, at 36 weeks. Sorry. She at 32 weeks, they said she was 5 pounds.
Okay. I was going to say 7 at,
yeah,
32. I was like, that's huge.
I misspoke. My okay. bad. But yeah. And then I turned 39 weeks on a Sunday, and it was actually my last day of work. I went to work. And then the next day when I was 39.1, that was my scheduled induction. So the big difference between that and when I had my induction with Leo was with him, I had no idea I was going to be induced, and it was terrifying. With her, I could kind of mentally prepare, and I had already gone through an induction. But with it being a morning induction, I wasn't sure how they were going to do it. And every time I went to the doctor those 4 weeks before, they would check my cervix, but I was still only like 1 centimeter dilated. And I had a few instances of false labor. One where I'd went to the ER or to the triage thinking I was in labor, because I was contracting like every 4 minutes for like 5-6 hours, and then it just stopped and I wasn't dilated any. It was really disappointing.
Yeah. That's such an emotional like tug of war too. False labor. But I will say, I kind of hate that it's called false labor, because even if it's not necessarily dilating you, like some sort of progress has got to be happening somewhere along the lines, you know?
Yeah.
So at least it's working in our favor at some point. I know of women who have had like so much false labor, but then end up having really, really quick, real active labors. So I don't wish that on anybody, but at least that part makes it a little bit more worth it.
Yeah, that's true. I didn't think about that.
So you ended up going in for that scheduled induction. Was it almost, I mean, it was easier because you were prepared, but was it almost like harder knowing like, oh, it's coming, and like having that impending date where it felt like it took forever to get there?
Well, so at the beginning of this pregnancy, I was like, I'm making it to 40 weeks this time. I want to make it to my due date. I was so excited. She was due August 1st. I was like, I'm going to have an August baby. Like half my family's born in July. I was like, I got to make it to August and she'll probably be late, blah, blah, blah. And then when they told me at 36 weeks that I had to be induced at around 39, I was like, great. And then originally when they scheduled my induction, they couldn't get me until that Thursday, and I ended up being induced on a Monday. So I was gonna wait till like I was almost 40 weeks anyway, and I was like, why?
Right.
And I wasn't going to the doctor in between either, which made me very nervous. But the doctor ended up getting me pushed up so I could be induced earlier, because I was very uncomfortable. I was measuring like 42 weeks at that point, and by then everything was swollen. My stomach was so big that the bottom of my stomach was swollen, like pitting edema. It was very painful. So I was just very ready to be done. That's why I kept hoping to go into labor, but it just never happened. So I was nervous about the induction, but I was kind of like, at least I know what to expect. And like, at least I have an end in sight.
Yeah, exactly.
So, but yeah, so we went in, they had to like call me for the induction. We woke up at like 4 a.m. because they said they could call between 5 and 9, and they called at 6 and told me to come in at 7:30. So we got there at 7:30, and then they started the induction by like 8:30. In the morning, and they ended up doing the Foley bulb again, but with the Pitocin at the same time.
Interesting.
So yeah. So I had told the doctor and the nurse that since I had extra amniotic fluid, there's more of a chance of like the cord sneaking out in front of the baby's head, the cord prolapse. So I told them I didn't want them to break my water until I had an epidural. So the epidural was like what I was definitely going to do this time, just in case something happened, so they could just rush me back so I could be awake for if I had to get a C-section.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So, Matt, she's crying. Basically, the Foley ball was so much worse this time with the Pitocin.
I was going to say, that sounds really awful.
Yeah, it was really uncomfortable. And I kept having to go to the bathroom to go pee and stuff because I didn't want an epidural yet. So I was just standing next to the bed or bouncing on the ball, trying to move as much as possible. But I didn't want to walk in the hall because of COVID. So I just walked around the room. And at Duke, we pull on the Foley bulbs to like help them come out. We don't pull like hard, but we like just kind of tug on it. So the nurse wasn't doing that. So I just decided to tug on my own Foley bulb to try and like encourage it to come out. And then it finally did come out, like after it was only in for like 2 hours.
I know your second time around too could be a factor, but I wonder if even though it was more intense with the Pitocin, if it was like quicker because it was, you know, in conjunction with the Pitocin, maybe it wouldn't have to be in as long.
Yeah, I was hopeful and it worked out. So I got it to come out and I told the nurse and I was like, but I'm not ready for my epidural yet, because by then when it came out, I felt amazing and was like, I don't really feel the contractions anymore. So I'm going to wait. And I waited like 2 or 3 more hours. And then I finally got the epidural and then they broke my water and I was like 5 centimeters. But the problem with my epidural this time is it didn't really work. And I just kept feeling a ton of pressure. But every time they would check me, they'd be like, you're still like 5, you're still 6. So I had to get a bolus of the epidural and that worked for a little bit. And then So the bolus, basically anesthesia comes in and can give you extra medicine through the epidural catheter. Because the medicine that's going through it just isn't covering it. And so they check that and they check the placement of it to make sure it's still in. And if the epidural had started coming out or if the bolus still hadn't worked, then they'd probably have to replace the epidural. But the bolus had worked for a little bit, at least for like a few hours. So I was able to take like a little nap. And then I started having a lot more pressure and pain again, and I had my nurse and she checked me and she was like, I'd say you're like 8. And then like 10 minutes later, she checked me again and she's like, you're like 9. And then like 5 minutes later, they were like, you're like a lip, which is 9.5. And so I just progressed really fast. So when I started pushing, I was 10, but the baby was only at 0 stations. So that's like, if you look at your pelvis, the station is the last number in there. We usually do like dilation, effacement, and station. And station is where the baby's head is within the pelvis. So 0 is like right at the ischial spines. And then we want them to be like +1, +2 before they start pushing. But I was only at 0 station, but was feeling so much pressure that I wanted to start pushing. So I started pushing and I pushed maybe like 4 times. And then the baby's heart rate went down. She had like a really big deceleration. So they flipped me into hands and knees just to help her heart rate come back up. She had a, it was an almost 7 minute long deceleration. Her heart rate dropped into the 90s. So the doctor came in, and the nurse, all, a bunch of nurses were in there. They all like run in. They put like the surgical hat on my head, like getting, the doctor said, if that happens again, we're going to go for a C-section. And I was like, okay. And I'm basically like in so much pain because the epidural's not working. And, I also, when I was pushing, I felt like I couldn't breathe because of all the fluid. So when they broke my water earlier, not that much fluid came out because it's all behind the baby. So it's all at the top of my stomach. Mm. So when I'm pushing, I feel like I couldn't breathe. So when I was in hands and knees, I started pushing, kind of just bearing down. So when they pushed, they flipped me back over. I pushed once and the nurse was like, stop pushing because she was like about to come out.
Oh, wow.
Sorry. My mouth is dry.
You're good. So when you, so was the doctor in there when she said that?
So the doctor had like just gotten back in and she was like, you can push one time. And this has happened. So with both babies, I had had them during shift change. So the nurses were switching out. So this time, it had just turned to like, it was right after seven and the new nurse was in there and she was like, well, let's flip you back over. Baby's doing well. Let's, start pushing again. So they flipped me back over and I pushed once and that's when she told me to stop. And that's when the doctor had just come in the room. So then I'm sitting there and with no epidural, really, I could feel like the baby crowning the whole time, that darn ring of fire. And I had to wait for the doctor to put his gown and gloves on and he's taking forever or what feels like forever. And I'm just like, can I push? Like, I'm literally yelling at my like husband and my mom and the nurse. I'm like, can I please push? So finally he gets right there. I push two more times and she's out. And after she comes out, there's like a flood of water because all that extra amniotic fluid, yeah, it got all over the doctor. So I'm like, I know why he put his gown on.
Yeah.
But, and then he's holding the baby. He put her on top of me and then like, but she, so when babies are stressed, like when they're coming out, they have what's called terminal meconium. So their meconium comes out like when they're being born and that's what happened. So she pooped on the doctor too.
Nice. I'm sure he's like, oh, this is an awesome day.
And I'm like, well, I mean, you could have went faster with putting the gown on. I was dying.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. I know.
But yeah, and then she was fine and she was here. It was great.
Yeah. That's awesome.
Did you a little more stressful, but yeah, very, I love, it was amazing.
Just out of curiosity, from like having such quick pushing times, did you have much tearing?
So, I was lucky. I didn't tear with either of my children.
That's awesome.
With Leo, he was 6 pounds, 14 ounces. So he's a little peanut. And then, the doctor, even when I came in for my induction, he's like, oh, she's 9 pounds. She was 7 pounds, 12 ounces.
Yeah. Just another, I mean, I feel like that happens every time I talk to moms and friends who have had like normal sized babies, and all along a doctor were like, oh, this is going to be huge. It's going to be like 9 or 10 pounds. We need to go ahead and get it out. And then they're like 7 pounds or 6 pounds. And they're like, okay.
Yeah, exactly. Like what, that's what Becky told me.
Yeah.
With her, they told her he was going to be so big and he was smaller than Leo was.
he wasn't even 7 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's nuts. But like, I'm sure that doctors have seen big babies be an issue, but it's almost like that it's like that management instead of like the expecting what can go wrong instead of the fact that like most of the time it is normal.
Mm-hmm.
Or like the margin of error on the ultrasounds is off. And sometimes with big babies, like moms still birth them fine.
Yep.
There isn't really much correlation of that and issues from like statistics.
And your bodies are like, we're made to push them out. Like most of the time they don't get stuck.
Right.
So,
but you know, same thing like with a plane crash, you hear of it happening once and then that's like all you think about when you hear that word, right?
Yeah.
So I get it, but that's why I'm like, I almost get frustrated when doctors or midwives tell moms that, especially in the later stages of their pregnancy, because all it does is make them scared and give them these mm-hmm. beliefs that they are not capable of doing it when they are most of the time. Mm-hmm. And our mind can really dictate so much like physiologically. So anyway, this is just another testament to that.
You're exactly. Like a
super, super pusher.
I've had other moms as patients where like, you don't think their baby's going to be that big. And then they come out and the baby's like 9.5 pounds.
Yeah.
I'm like, where were you hiding this baby? I know. It's like, it's so weird how moms' bodies are so different.
They are. And
you can't tell.
I know of one of my friends is like super small frame, like tiny, tiny, and had like an over 9 pound baby.
Mm-hmm.
And actually in the VBAC training that I just did with my doula cert, we learned that there's like apparently like 14 different shapes of pelvises out there. And they're like, they have all these different names. And I was looking at them like, oh my gosh, I had no clue that was even a thing. But I guess just goes to show like bodies are going to pretty much grow what they can push out for the most part.
I wonder what shape my pelvis is.
Yeah, I have no clue what mine is either, but I'll have to pull up those notes again and look through it and show you, because I was like, dang, this is crazy. I had no clue. It is wild. Well, how is postpartum with her? How is it going from 1 to 2?
From 1 to 2, it's so much easier than going from 0 to 1, in my opinion. Even though we don't get as much sleep, I love the newborn stage with all the snuggles and just trying to relax. The relaxing is a little harder with a toddler, but we find things to do and it's just so cute to see them together. And
yeah,
I don't know. I feel like I kept telling my mom and Matt, I was like, I'm so much more excited for postpartum this time.
Yeah.
Cause I know what to expect in a way. And, but I also know like not to have my expectations too high, because so much happens that, I mean, especially with breastfeeding, but breastfeeding is going way better this time. I'm also giving myself way more grace
mm-hmm.
with it. With Leo, I'd be like, he wants to eat again. And he was just like exhausted all the time. And this time I'm like, okay, she's probably not really hungry, but she wants to be comforted. And so it's like, I'm here for her.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. But that's kind of what I would imagine when I think about experiencing it next time. I'm like, I think it's going to be physically harder because you don't have as much space to like just sleep.
Mm-hmm.
But I think in like the grand scheme of things, just being more prepared, knowing what to expect, like you said, and like having your expectations so much lower than mm-hmm. the first time, I think, again, like that mental game is just affects everything when you're just so new and like don't know what you're really doing or what to expect or if you're doing it wrong or right. And you feel like there's all these rules that you need to be following. And once you realize that actually you're the mom, you can do whatever the heck you need to do to take care of your baby. It's like, oh, this light bulb goes off. So,
yeah. And I mean, at least this time, I'm not as worried about, like, you know, milestones and all that stuff.
Yeah. It's kind of happens as it happens. And every baby grows and develops at their own pace.
Yeah, exactly. Every baby's different. And like, we're dealing with that now, like with Leo, because he's two. So he has his appointment soon. And he's saying words, but he's not like making as much sense with a lot of stuff. But he's also doing so much more than he was a month ago. So,
right. Yeah.
I'm like, he's just going at his own pace. And
yeah, I know. And it's hard. It's hard not to compare, especially when you go to doctor's appointments and they give you like a checklist of things that they should be doing. And you're just like, oh gosh, am I going to have to be, you know, dealing with X, Y, and Z. But yeah, then it's like the next time you go, they make all these strides and you're like, oh, well, they're growing, they're developing, they're gaining all these skills that they should be. It's just not necessarily at like this textbook pace that they're giving you.
Yeah. And I feel like my parents do that sometimes. Like my mom's like, well, you knew the alphabet when you were 18 months old. And I was like, okay. That's crazy. Like, but that's not normal.
Exactly. Yeah. I think it was Silas's like 9 month appointment, maybe like 6 or 9 months, I forget, somewhere around there. And they had given me this like laminated piece of paper that I had to go through with a dry erase marker and like check off, you know, doing this all the time, sometimes, never, whatever. And I was on all these different categories and I had to go through and check all these things off. And the sections where there was a lot of nevers or nos, I was just like, oh my gosh, is he like behind? What's going on? And then the doctor was like, well, you know, a few of these areas are kind of like borderline, but he's developing. It's fine. Every baby's different. And then literally, I'm not even kidding, we went home from that appointment and the next day he was doing like half of the stuff. And I was like, what the heck? This is crazy.
Exactly. Literally, and I feel like sometimes it's like, we're not even paying attention until they point out these things and you're like, oh, well, I don't know. And then they do it and you're like, they are doing it.
Exactly. You just kind of have to be paying attention in the first place. That's so true. Well, I guess wrapping up your birth stories, I like to ask this too with moms who have now been through it a couple of times, like what did you learn or kind of what shaped you in your first birth experience that you took with you into your second?
Just like, I don't know, doing it the first time, it's like, I just felt so empowered. I was like, wow, I did it.
Yeah.
So this time I was like, I can definitely do it.
Yeah.
And I don't know. The first time I didn't want an epidural. So when I did get it, I felt kind of defeated. But this time I was like, well, I'm getting one just in case something happens.
Right.
But I'm open with the next one not getting one. Like, I'm more like go with the flow. With my first one, I had a birth plan, but I didn't have it with me because I didn't know I was getting induced.
Yeah.
So I just kind of told them what I wanted. But with the second one, I was just kind of like, well, just go with the flow. I know what I want and what I don't want.
Yeah.
And everything works out.
That's the process of why making birth plans and like getting educated is powerful, because even if you don't necessarily like decide on, or like, you know, you changed your mind or ended up getting the epidural the first time and you mentioned, you know, kind of feeling weird about that initially, but when you go into it like just educated and empowered, then you know that you can walk away feeling proud that, well, I knew what was best for me and I made that decision. And I didn't have to feel any disappointment or guilt mm-hmm. because I knew what my options were. You know, it's just a little, the perspective is different there.
Yeah, exactly. And with the first birth, like we took a birthing class, which the second time I didn't feel like I needed to do, but I know people that they take one with every baby just to like reiterate what is in their mind, like what they need to know and what their options are. So
yeah, absolutely. I think it can't hurt. Information and education is never gonna like do you any harm, in my opinion. So to a certain extent, sometimes too much information can be a little crippling. So I get that.
Yeah.
Well, thanks so much for coming on. I will link like your Instagram and stuff again, as usual, in the show notes if anyone wants to reach out and connect with you. But thanks so much for coming on again.
Thank you for having me. It's fun.
We'll talk to you guys next time. Bye.